The pandemic has seen a lot of things put on hold. One of them was the UN climate change conference that was delayed. That'll go ahead later this year.
The UK government has confirmed that the UN climate change conference, due to be held in Glasgow in November, has been postponed.
Another was CO2 emissions. The pandemic saw a 7% fall in emissions during 2020. That was the biggest since World War II.
Well, global greenhouse gas emissions are on track to take an historic plunge in 2020.
But the relief is temporary, and the climate crisis is still looming, ready to come back into focus as the world tries to turn to normality. There is a new president in the White House, and countries around the world are setting carbon neutral targets. But the problems we face are only getting starker. The world's population is expected to rise from 7 billion now to 9 billion by 2035. Since 1992, emissions from energy have risen by more than half. And as the population grows, inevitably demand on scarce resources grows too. The World Food Organization reckons that the number of people facing starvation has doubled during the pandemic, from 135 million to 270.
Right now, while we're dealing with COVID-19 pandemic, we're also on the brink of a hunger pandemic. Millions of civilians living in conflict-scarred nations, including many women and children, face being pushed to the brink of starvation with the specter of famine, a very real and dangerous possibility.
A billion people are still going hungry. 2 billion are obese or overweight. A third of all food goes to waste. And the food industry produces a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions. And this leaves us wrestling with two big questions. How do you decarbonize a world without undermining living standards? And how do you feed that growing population sustainably? Two Tetra Pak thinkings dealing with those issues covered very different ground. But the solutions to both, it seems, have to rest on corporate action, consumer demand, and global coordination. In the first of these thinkings, which focused on decarbonisation, we heard from Claire Perry, the former UK Minister for Clean Energy and Growth. For her, change won't start with COP, the climate change conference, but with institutions, with governments, and our financial systems.
We should expect this COP, regardless of what happens in the negotiating halls, to be a massive moment of truth about where we're going, what the climate trajectory is, and what we're going to do about it. The truth of the matter is this. I sat in the Madrid COP all the way through, the last one we had because we lost a year. We had 500,000 people protesting in Madrid, pleading with us to take action now. I sat in a meeting with the whole negotiating plenary where the topic of debate was what was the title of the meeting we were in. For that room, the level of ambition and action expressed outside it has very little meaning. And it's not to say it's not a valuable process, because ultimately you have to have some structural framework to bring people together. But the more we can do with companies, with the financial system, with our own governments expressed through the ballot box, the more we will have a chance to influence this actual outcome. And I'm afraid to say that the tragedy of all of this is, you know, since the first Rio Earth Summit, emissions from energy are up over 50%. People may have seen the International Meteorological Organization report yesterday. We all thought COVID, you know, look, this is the future. Demand collapsed. We emptied the planes. We all stopped traveling. Guess what? It hasn't even registered.
It was a point made time and again in the discussion. And Jan Duplessis, non-executive chairman of the BT Group, went further. In fact, his pessimism reflected an urgency shared by all the contributors.
But I want to come back to the role of government. And I'm sorry to say, I think Claire, thankfully, will prefer to be called tonight as an ex-politician rather than a politician. I have sympathy with the job of governments, but they're fundamentally dishonest. And I'm not talking just about our government. I'm talking everywhere. They are great at painting pictures about achievements by the 2030s and the 35s and all what we're going to do in the future. They consistently refuse to do the things that are deeply unpopular today. So, for example, in the UK, why many years ago we stopped with what used to be called the fuel price escalator to try and discourage the use of diesel and petrol? Because it's politically unpopular. Why do we not tax the consumption of gas in domestic heating? Because it is obvious we have to decarbonize domestic heating and switch people eventually towards electrification with the possibility of renewables. Why? Because it's politically deeply unpopular. And I understand that. But until governments are prepared to make unpopular choices, there's a limit to what people achieve. And ultimately, therefore, it's going to have to come through the ballot box.
Business may be at an advantage when it comes to following through. Jan said BT's efforts to use less energy weren't motivated just by a desire to be green or be seen to be green. They made good business sense. So reframing the way people think about environmental initiatives as not just the right thing to do, but simple common sense, sounds essential. And Claire Perry said she saw the same shift in attitudes among the public that he sees in some businesses.
There's something about the connection with nature. I mean, maybe it's just I've been locked down in the middle of the Wiltshire countryside in my old constituency, but there is something very powerful about people's desire to reconnect with a better, healthier way of life, to think more mindfully about what they eat, to value other things. And I think those are points the Green Party has made very successfully, and they're actually really resonating people. And this is, I believe, why so many companies are on the transition, because you know what? CEOs are people too, and they have kids and they have grandchildren. And there is a sense of we've kind of really stressed the world. I believe very strongly in the power of capitalism to generate prosperity, but I also believe in the power of well-regulated markets and companies to do good. And so there's something about that powerful Green Party narrative that I actually find very compelling. And I think a lot of people increasingly feel that, even if they don't vote for them at the ballot box.
Another strong theme to emerge from our discussion was the importance of breaking the cycle of waste, of circularity. Tetra Pak's own Lars Holmqvist spoke of how the company is looking to reduce waste in its supply chain.
It's really critical for the food and beverage industry, first of all, never mind packaging, to meet two goals, really. One is to ensure food safety and food availability all around the world. That's the food and beverage industry. That's what we're about. But at the same time, minimize the impact on the planet and the limited resources that it carries. So it's not really an either or situation here. We need to balance both these requirements, and they're fundamental to our sustainable future. But really, coming back to the climate emergency that we are facing, you know, rapid decarbonization, as you call it, is really the need of the hour, the way we see it. And circularity, so collection and recycling and the circular economy, is definitely a part of that solution, because it keeps materials in use and reduces the environmental impact. That's clear. But it's only really part of the answer, because given the limited infrastructure that is there in many parts of the world, so a more comprehensive approach that we believe in, it is to look at the full life cycle. So focus on decarbonizing the products as well as the operations. So the products being the packaging, but also the equipment that is used to package and process food.
Packaging, processing, and the equipment used in those processes. And there's something else, the elephant in the room, waste. The session ended on a note from Lars, which set up the next thinking. Because the food industry's large carbon footprint globally comes mainly from food waste as opposed to production. Waste always has a negative climate impact, and arguably there's no greater source of waste than in food.
I think what we need to do is to talk about facts and talk about data. And if you look today, and I'm very happy that this question on food waste came up, because if you look at the data, we know that food and food production, but food waste has a big impact on the climate and the carbon emissions. And so if we talk about data, let's say 30% of all food today is wasted. And we in the food and beverage industry, and specifically when you have aseptic packaging technology, we know that every package, let's say, that we can package safely without preservatives, without refrigeration, that lasts for 1 year, can be distributed to all corners of the world, regardless of the infrastructure, you know, the roads, the heat, and so on, and be consumed, you know, safely within at least a year. And all of that with minimizing the food waste and the footprint, the carbon footprint along the. So if we talk about it in those terms and adding facts and examples of how we contribute, you know, we are part of the problem, there's no doubt, but we're also part of the solution.
So we ended this thinking with some pretty clear ideas on the importance of systemic change, of top-down changes in manufacturing cycles, energy use, and transparency about when targets are hit and when they're missed. And equipped with these ideas, we can start to see a path forward to carbon neutrality worldwide, to driving down emissions even as populations increase and the demand for better standards of living intensifies. Data, transparency, coordination, these are all vital tools in helping to make better, more informed, and more sustainable choices. I want to come back to a point made by Lars at the end of the thinking on decarbonising the planet, a point about food waste. Before even health and education come the two imperatives of food and sustainability. We have to eat to live, and we have to eat sustainably for the planet to remain habitable. Hence the question for our second thinking: how will we feed the world sustainably after COVID? It's a question with implications for the debate on decarbonising our planet. The answers overlap, and there's the same tension at the heart of both. As demand increases and resources tighten, how do we ensure sustainability and fairness across the world? Now, there's a legitimate debate over whether aggregate food production needs to be radically increased, and if so, by how much. But there's less room for argument over the need to cut waste, get more food to those who need it most, and shift the whole enterprise onto a sustainable footing. As Erthrin Cousin, who's the former executive director of the World Food Programme, said, this is something that has been brought into stark focus by the pandemic.
Well, we must have hope. The reality is that before the pandemic, there was a recognition that we, as a global community, needed to increase production of food by 70% by 2050 to feed a population that's projected at 9.5 to 10 billion. During the pandemic, what we saw was our food systems fail in a number of different ways. But what we saw were ports that failed. Because in net importing countries where the population was on lockdown, and so they didn't have adequate port support for taking product off ships. We witnessed situations where with curfews in a developing country, think about this, curfews in a developing country, I am a truck driver from bringing produce from the rural areas into the city. There's no refrigerated trucks. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm now required because of curfews to drive during the day, that means produce is now spoiling on trucks. Mm-hmm. Because of the heat. And so the lack of access to refrigeration resulted in more product wasted. So what the pandemic did was unbared the challenges in the food systems that many of us were aware of, but did not have the support from the business community or governments and from a development standpoint to address those fine-tuning issues. And so now what the conversation that is ongoing is, how do we build back better? There is one challenge that was projected that we still remain very concerned about. Before the pandemic, there were about 135 million people living on the verge of starvation. Those 135 million people are primarily living in conflict areas, areas that's significantly affected by climate or by economic or political instability in their countries. We've witnessed that number expand to about 270 million people now living on the verge of starvation. That number is one that we should always be aware of. And while we're addressing these market issues, we also need to recognize the humanitarian issues.
Solving this riddle, as Tetra Pak's own Charles Brand says, is both a climate problem and a technology problem.
Now, when we talk about food security, and coming back to Erithrin's and some of Hanukkah's points on all of the issues, this is about taking a product, sometimes over long distances, out to a consumer in all four corners of the world. And to do that, it does come back to the technology that's used. Now, if I combine the technology, the functionality, together with sustainability, because that one third of the world's food that goes to waste, you can translate all of that into climate equivalents.
Technology, practicality, and sustainability. They all come together in tackling what is both a climate and a logistics problem. And during this thinking, we got three clear, concrete proposals as to how to address it. One is for a traffic light system informing consumers about the environmental impact of their produce. The basic idea is not unfamiliar, as Hanneke Faber, president of Food and Refreshments at Unilever, pointed out.
So really what I would be a huge supporter of, and Unilever would be a huge supporter of, would be kind of traffic lights for the planet. But it is a large piece of work. And as you say, I don't want to be marking my own homework. So that can be a Unilever scheme, because that's the turkey voting for Christmas. So that needs a coalition of people who come together and an independent referee of some kind to make sure that the data that goes in and that eventually ends up on the pack or online for consumers is kind of fair and balanced, which is not so easy. Exhibit one, all the discussions around Nutri-Score in Europe, where, you know, frozen pizza can get a B score and be quite healthy, whereas the Italian olive oil gets a D. So it's not straightforward, and it won't be for the planet either.
Charles Brand agreed with Hanneke, but he emphasized that this was an initiative that would require collaboration between different sectors and companies.
Industry should come together, and they do through the associations, and agree on certain types of measurements. I think here the authorities can also help a little bit here in creating more of a standardization on what we should be measuring, and we all agree around those things. It needs to go there, because we've talked about the consumer before, and often the consumer gets confused because they don't really know what it is that they're looking at. And I suppose the traffic light system, red, yellow, green, maybe that's the simplest measure. But when you come to more complex things like CO2 and other things, it's what is good and what is not good. And having those benchmarks and yardsticks made clearer and giving the consumer an ability to truly understand whether something is better or worse for themselves, for obesity and health, better or worse for the environment, that's very important.
As with ideas for carbon neutrality, the consensus was clear that any scheme like this needs not just industry and individual companies to come together, but support too from governments and intergovernmental bodies. And that brought us to a second proposal from Erthurin Cousin, a Paris-style agreement for food security and access.
I'm hopeful that the global community will come together, just as we did with the Paris Climate Accord, around a set of goals and game-changing ideas that will support the development of a food system that will not only support our planet and the planetary issues that we've been talking about, but also ensure that food access, food affordability for all is a reality. The kinds of answers that we've been talking about here today, with increasing the cost of food, we don't need to produce more food because enough food is produced. It depends upon where you live and what your economic situation is. And so developing solutions as a global community that leave no one behind is what I am hopeful of, that the UN agencies will work with governments and business and academic leaders to realize as a part of the Food System Summit.
The third and final proposal was to take a whole life cycle approach to feeding the world sustainably. That is, to make sure that emissions from production and packaging and distribution and consumption are all factored in. It is, as Charles Brand said earlier, a logistical and technological problem, but solving it is vital if people are to have access to food wherever they are in the world. Just as Lars said in relation to the aim of making Tetra Pak carbon neutral in the first thinking, Charles Brand reiterated that same ambition in this one.
You know, when you only focus on one part of the value chain, you can often get the wrong conclusions on whether it's good or bad. And we're a big advocate of life cycle analysis, where you take from the beginning of the life cycle of the product all the way through to end of life, where it is either being reused or recycled or whatever happens to it. And when you take that total life cycle approach, you include all of the different elements that there are in the product, and then that gives you comparability from one product to another. The external measurement of that is incredibly important because, yeah, you know, obviously as a company, we're not always, we like to think that we're very trustworthy, but we're not always trusted. And so we always use external sources to do the life cycle analyses. And in fact, in everything that we do, from FSC certification of forestry to the CDP measurement of our climate program and many other measurements, the RE100, we always use those external certifications to make sure that we are on the right track from an externally measured perspective.
Justin King of Sainsbury's frequently offered a dissenting view, but also a reminder of the other side of the coin. If the challenge is a global one, he said, it's not just on producers, manufacturers and governments to enact change, but on consumers to push for it.
I think that all have to play their part and play their part on the right dimensions. And I would always encourage commercial organisations to look for where the competitive issues lie in the issues within their supply chain and seek to take a position that differentiates them, and then take responsibility to communicate that to consumers, because nothing changes commercial behaviour quicker than consumers behaving differently with this thing, the wallet. Too often, I think we go for collaboration. It has its part. It's certainly more important across borders and across issues. But you know, those two C's and using them the right way, I think, is incredibly important.
But it's not as simple as watching what people do with their wallets. Companies, King says, have to anticipate demand as well as respond to it.
In the end, the thing that will fundamentally allow the supply chain to change is the consumer engaging in a different way. And of course, it's not acceptable for business, for commerce, to sit back and say, we'll wait until the consumer changes and then we'll respond to it. You often hear retailers, consumer goods companies saying, you know, we respond to our consumers. Well, no business like Sainsbury's or Unilever that's been around for a decade or more got to where it did today, waiting to respond to consumers. You've got to be ahead of that curve.
Justin King also suggests the pandemic has shown the global food system is not broken, but resilient. Food output doesn't need to grow by 70% by mid-century. Rather, he says, prices need to rise in the rich north to cut waste. And even if we can agree on food security goals, competition, he says, is as important as collaboration in attaining them. So how do we reconcile this view with those of the other speakers who argued for stronger supply chains, increased food production, and a focus on affordability and collaboration? Well, King's is arguably a view formed in the developed world, while the others bring a more global perspective. But in the end, the apparent disagreement brings me back to two main ideas brought up throughout the thinking by Tetra Pak's own Charles Brand. As he said on the importance of a traffic light system, it's not just about companies and industries coming together. It's about providing consumers with better information to make better choices. And on this, maybe Justin King wasn't that far apart from the other contributors after all. Whether on carbon neutrality or food security, there is no silver bullet. But there is perhaps a shared key to achieving both these goals. Consumers. It's us as consumers and voters who truly have the power to affect change, to insist on more sustainable supply chains, and to acquire better eating habits. Traffic light systems, smart packaging, better governance, these all play a role in what is clearly a complex project demanding multiple solutions. And it's a project for which we all need to start taking responsibility